reprogramming.
Well, good afternoon. This is Rita Schulte and Pledge Central here at WILL Radio, and I'm with Richard Borowski. And we're here to ask you to do something very simple, and that is to go to your phone and join those business partners as a friend of WILL. And we're encouraging especially new friends to come on board this afternoon. Some of our returning members, folks who maybe hadn't given for about a year or so, have combined together, and they have issued a challenge for $550 if we can hear from at least 10 new friends this afternoon during Afternoon Magazine. So far, we have heard from one. We'd like to say thank you to Kurt Martin from Indianola and W.T. Arnold from Effingham and William Wiley from Paxton, who are just some of the folks who have great faith in WILL Radio and pledged their dollars to encourage you to pledge your dollars. Now, Richard, we've been here. This is our fourth day during the Afternoon Magazine. We have had some terrific programs so far this week, and we've got something wonderful coming up. This has been like, are dust bunnies an endangered species in your house, Richard?
Is this PBS radio, or this NPR radio, or what? I mean, where else do people get excited about other people's dirt?
Well, that is, I don't know. The front of the Inquirer. But this is a different kind of dirt. And what we'd like, stay with us. This is a great program. Don't even think about turning to another station. This is going to be terrific.
Now, for an explanation or description of what this program is about to, what this program is going to be about, Dusting for Clues, in just one short paragraph, this person who cleans other people's homes and has discovered so much about what can be told about other people by what is in their home, she's talking about $1.2 million portfolios, the term CIA is mentioned, all sorts of things.
And you can have a copy of her book as a drawing prize. Call during this hour of the Afternoon Magazine, and we'll be having a drawing for Louise Rafkin's book. We'd like to hear from 10 folks this afternoon. The number to call is 217-244-9455. Richard, how much to give?
You can become a supporter by student or fixed income friend at $25. Basic membership, $40. $60, Enjoy Patterns Magazine. So many different options at the $120 level. $5 a month.
$10 a month. 10 times 12
is 120. But it, just $60, $5 a month. Mm-hmm. It all makes a difference. Rita began this break by saying how simple it is. I'd like to come close to finishing by saying how important it is that we hear from you right now. Those of you who join us every afternoon, you have that midday cup of coffee.
And maybe that bagel.
With Celeste. Mm-hmm. Almost every
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Do you have someone in to help with house cleaning? Do you need up a bit before the house cleaner arrives? Maybe you feel a tad bit silly about that. But then again, maybe it's not such a bad idea. Our dirt is quite revealing, and we're about to find out how revealing. Our guest this afternoon is Louise Rafkin. In addition to being a writer, she's been a cleaner of houses. It's helped keep a roof over her head. Louise Rafkin shares what she's learned about house cleaning in a new book titled Other People's Dirt, A House Cleaner's Curious Adventures. The book won't tell you how to do a spit-and-polish clean attic to basement a la Good Housekeeping or Martha Stewart, but it could have you laughing out loud and looking around your place with the eye of a detective. Do join the conversation this afternoon. Your calls are welcome in Champaign-Urbana, the number 333-9455. Anywhere else you're listening, in Illinois or Indiana, call us toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Louise Rafkin has written for many periodicals, including the New York Times Magazine, Utney Reader, and the Ladies' Home Journal. She's also been a commentator for National Public Radio. Other People's Dirt, A House Cleaner's Curious Adventures, is published by Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill. Toll-free 1-800-222-9455 in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Your questions and comments are welcome. Louise Rafkin, good afternoon. Welcome.
Hi, Celeste.
How are you?
Good.
Good.
Great.
Growing up, what was your family's home like on a scale of, you know, 10 being most tidy?
Well, I'd say it was sort of a 9.5.
Wow.
My mother is very fastidious. My father sorted his golf balls in various boxes in the garage from dirty to clean.
Mm.
So as much as I didn't like it, and it used to chafe me, I somehow became my parents and in sort of fastidious myself now.
Yeah. You earned the Girl Scouts housekeeping badge.
I certainly did.
So when you were a kid, were you helpful around the house?
Oh, I was sort of a good girl. I think I talk in the book about how I really wanted to be a spy, but I couldn't imagine breaking any laws and breaking into any people's houses. So, you know, I did have quite a big fantasy life about joining the CIA and being three days of the Condor person and
right.
All kinds of things. But really, I can't even watch a scary movie on the TV without running out doing the dishes, which assuages my tension. So, you know, I was a good girl, and I earned this badge. And I also earned, even though it was, like, completely dorky and embarrassing, the home ec student of the year when I was in junior high school.
This was like round about the 70s.
Yeah, it was like 72 or 3, and it was just really not cool to be home ec student of the year. You know, people were sort of wearing bell bottoms and doing free love, and there I was in my little A-frame skirt, and I made the correct number of cookies on the recipe, so I think that clinched me the title there.
Yeah, but you also thought of yourself as a feminist.
Exactly. I debated Phyllis Schlafly about the ERA when I was a young teen and, you know, didn't expect to be anyone's house cleaner in some kind of way. So it was sort of a shock to me as well. And I like the work. I just was speaking to someone this morning about how physically it's work that I enjoy. You get it done, and it looks better, and there's
mm-hmm.
tangible results. So even though I sort of fancied myself either in the CIA or president, it doesn't seem too outrageous that I'm doing this other thing here and there.
Yeah. I've never stopped to think about, you know, doing the dishes as sort of a relaxing activity, but, you know, it can be. I mean, you can actually stand there by yourself and look out the window.
You can, if you're not thinking, I have to get through.
Right.
Yeah, and actually, you know, to me, I have a chapter in my book called Cleaning Up My Life, and I do think that it can help you process things. Like, being human is making a mess. I mean, I say, mm-hmm. you know, we are sort of here to decompose and fall apart and recycle ourselves, and you know, we don't often take a moment to think about what that really means. You know, constantly we're making a mess and cleaning them up, emotional or physical or otherwise.
Mm. What was your first job?
Oh, it was this crazy job for a gynecologist and his wife, and I was... you mean my first job cleaning when I was a kid? I was...
Well, that was a very early one.
Yeah, I got offered a job at a woman that I had been previously spying on.
Right.
And I was so worried that she was going to catch me, and I had this whole fantasy about her life inside the house and how, you know, she was probably married to a murderer and blah, blah, blah. I made up all these stories, and then, of course, one day she offered me a job cleaning her house, and I found out it was just awful. And you know, a lot you can find out from someone's dirty underclothing, but... you know, it was like all my fantasies of how exciting her life were not really true.
Crushed.
Yes. The boredom and tedium of actually just having to wash out somebody's pantyhose came crumbling down upon me.
That's not a very good job for a kid, is it, either?
Well, it was sort of that or flipping burgers. I don't know.
Mm.
I mean, that it was more interesting to me to actually engage with someone. And to be, still, I enjoyed going around her house and seeing, even as tedious as it was, how she actually lived.
Yeah. What have you learned about yourself, you know, over the course of this career as a house cleaner?
I think, you know, I've really, it's been really interesting to notice my own reactions to being invisible, for instance, you know, coming from a class background of not being invisible. I've had to look at how people treat other people who do supposedly menial work and what that means to me. And occasionally I get kind of grumpy about that, but it's been very humbling and also, I think in some ways, sort of a spiritual quest of like, wow, this is good work and people should clean up the planet. But I don't always feel that way. And if you read the book, know that I get a little grumpy and slightly stabby at people here and there for treating employees badly.
Yeah. Your family had a maid when you were growing up, Lupita.
Yes.
And she had a hard life.
She had a very hard life, and I interviewed her shortly before she died, and I was really quite stunned at, you know, here I was with all the opportunities afforded me in education and having been a teacher and whatnot, and talking with her about, you know, what were really her choices. She was pregnant, unmarried, in the 60s, living in Mexico, and her family basically, who were a landowning family, sent her away, and so, you know, what choices did she have? And boy, you know, she just aged and worked right up until her death. I have no idea how. And it made me very sad. And I think the world is, you know, often peopled by people like Lupita, who are here because they've been swept out of their own countries only to end up sweeping up this country.
Yeah. She died of lung cancer, and that led you to ask yourself about, you know,
ammonia.
Right, the dangers of the job.
It's terrible. And, you know, I'd like to say that I'm a green cleaner, but I'm not, because some of these killer products are just so dang darn easy. So, you know, I thought about her life. I mean, she also smoked. Who knows what it all means? But, you know, there's nobody's doing research on the long-term effects of household products on domestics. You know, it's just not a priority in this country. And that was sad to me.
Yeah. You don't use rubber gloves.
I don't use rubber gloves. They hinder my, you know, occasionally I've used the kind that you get at medical supply if something's really bad. And I have worked for ill people and I've used them. Uh-huh. But, you know, it's just like, who wants to have those bulky things? I just want to get in there.
I do.
You do.
I have them on.
Well, you're going to have better looking hands as you age than I am. That's for sure.
How do you take care of your hands?
Oh, they're terrible. I mean, you know, I'm a gardener and I do karate and I clean. It's a crazy thing. You know, I'm going to have like the gnarliest hands. So, we'll see. There are worse things. So, I guess it's character.
Yeah. You told us about your very first job when you were, you know, washing out the neighbor's hose.
Yeah.
But what was your real first job as a house cleaner? You know, when you were an adult and decided that this is what I'll do to pay the rent.
Well, you know, I had been living at an artist fellowship for 2 years, and I got quite spoiled. I was being supported, and I was writing short stories, and you know, it was lovely. I rent was paid, and I even got a stipend, and I just, you know, was on cloud nine, and I somehow forgot that it was going to end. During this time, I had started bartering cleaning services for, like, chiropractic, and people would find out that I was a cleaner and say, oh, I'd love to get my house clean. Can I trade you for this? And so I had, you know, various clients. I was getting massaged, and you know, I always thought that was pretty funny. I'd get all sore cleaning and then I'd get massaged. It was like a chicken and egg situation. But anyway, you know, there I was dumped out of the free rent moment, and people said, oh, you're a great cleaner. You can make a lot of money. And I put a little sign up. I was living in a place where there wasn't a lot of other employment opportunities on Cape Cod. It was very touristy and seasonal. And the phone just started ringing. I was just panicked. I was just like, oh, my God, I'm a cleaner. And I went to people's houses and I gave them these ridiculously low quotes. And, you know, that first summer I made a lot of mistakes. And I think that I did I cleaned this guy's whole house the entire summer for what he would have charged for a single pap smear. He was a gynecologist. And I think, you know, it was something like $22 by the time I had charge $10 an hour or something. But I learned pretty quick to jack up my prices. And, you know, that was the other thing, is that I was making enough money cleaning, or have always charged enough, that I don't get resentful. I feel like, you know, if you're in a situation where you're resentful, it's just not very healthy for anybody. So, you know, I just say, hey, I'm expensive, and there you go.
What does housekeeping pay?
Uh-oh. Well,
if I wanted to hire you.
What? If you wanted to hire me?
Yeah.
Well, okay, let's, how big's your house?
Well, it's pretty small. I'm in public radio, remember?
Okay, two bedrooms?
Two bedrooms.
How many square feet?
Maybe 1,200 square feet.
Okay. Well, all right. How does $75 sound to you? Too much? $60 to
$75? Yeah.
How many baths?
Well, maybe you'd better take a look around first.
Oh, it's bad. I should get battle pay.
I was getting ready for work today, and I was looking around, and I thought, I wonder what Louise Rafkin could tell about me. Number one, I'm a bad housekeeper.
Well, let me see. You know, the things I look at are, is someone going to have it done regularly? It makes it a lot easier for me.
Yeah.
Or do they say, I'll just call you when it needs it, and that means they're going to call you every 6 years. You know? And I've had that happen. I'm like, hello, you need it a little bit more than that. So, but you know, the irony is that I work with someone, and we've been working together a long time. Actually, I just gave her my business for the summer because I'm going to have to tour with the book and I'm not going to be able to clean. But she vacuums while I do the kitchens and bathrooms. And quite honestly, we can do a house usually under 2 hours. So even if I'm charging $60, we're both making good money. And usually, you know, it's cash. So there you go. You know, that's a good idea. Sometimes it's even more. You know, sometimes someone will pay whatever. I did write about working for one of these maid services, which was just sort of one of my adventures in the book. I go and I clean up after murders, and I went to Japan and lived with a sect of cleaning people who clean as a spiritual practice. So I did a lot of field trips in this book as well, and one of them was to work for a cleaning service, and they were charging, you know, $85 to $135 for city-sized houses, 3 or 4 bedrooms, and I was pretty horrified because we were making, each of us on that job, about $13 each. And so, you know, I don't think my prices were out of line and in any way, but I think that I'm also really fast and good. But, you know, I don't know, Celeste. I have to look in your refrigerator. And
What are the most revealing places in a home, most revealing spots, the most revealing rooms?
You know what? People always say, well, how can you know something from a house? And I just feel like a house is like a bigger outfit. You know how you know something from an outfit? Or you, somebody drives up in a Porsche, or somebody drives up in a Jeep Cherokee, or someone drives up in a 60s bug. You're like, oh, that says something.
Right.
Well, the house is this huge depository for millions of things that are being said. You know, I can walk into a house and I go, oh my God, lots of money, no taste. You know, that's the initial reaction. Maybe I'd walk into your house and say, you know, she reads, what is she reading? I would definitely go through what you're reading. If you're a National Public Radio person, I would think, oh, she's probably got some really good books around here. Let me see what she's reading.
You'd trip over them.
Make my way through them. You know, what is important to people is what's in their houses, and that can be a number of things. Whether it's no food in the fridge because there's an eating disorder, or, you know, a stack of sexual magazines by the bed because of whatever, you know. I mean, there's just stuff everywhere, and each thing tells a little story, and sometimes the whole story is in the medicine cabinet, and you can see all kinds of things in there that will tell you whatever. And sometimes the story is in the fridge, and sometimes the story is, you know, right out in the open. And maybe someone died, and there's a huge amount of photographs of that person. Or maybe, you know, there's an obsession. Or maybe the story is on the answering machine. I'm also there when the answering machine picks up. So, you know, I've heard a lot of things, and probably too many, really.
So, are you, Do you think of yourself as a snooper, or are the clues just out there, and as you're, you know, dusting, vacuuming, you know, kneading up, that, you know,
just trip over them, and then I have to talk about them. Well, I'm a naturally really curious person, and so I don't know where that comes from, but would I read diaries? No, I wouldn't crack the spine of a diary. I would not. I would be horrified if someone did that to me. But if there was a letter on the counter, it would be really hard for me to not glance at it. Or, so it's not like, I don't think I'm a bad person for snooping a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
I have to sort of straighten up everything, but nor do I think that I have met cleaners who said, no, I would never look at anything that wasn't, you know, put my way. And I think, wow, that takes an enormous amount of self-control and lack of curiosity. So I'm somewhere in the middle.
You know, I think if you weren't a writer and a house cleaner, that you might be an anthropologist or a sociologist.
Absolutely.
Or investigator, or
I think that I've looked at being a private investigator.
Really?
That was one of my, you know, I'm always looking for a new job. But I figure I should find a career at some point. But I have been a writer for a long time and written many, many different kinds of things. And I think that my life is definitely has the anthropological slant. Like, what do you know about people, and what kind of information is revealed? I just think it would be very dry to be an academic. It would be more fun just to go through and knock on doors here and there. I'm going to try to clean houses on my book tour, so hopefully I'll get to experience places that I haven't been. And, I'm going to the South soon. I'll get to clean in Raleigh and Charlotte. I've never cleaned down there, so who knows what I'll find.
That'd be a great publicity tactic.
Well, you know, I don't know. I have to do something.
Sweep into town to promote your book and, you know.
Well, I'm putting it out there. Anybody in Raleigh or Charlotte or Atlanta that wants their house cleaned, or D.C., call my publisher.
Make great TV, great radio.
It'll be fun, too.
Yeah. Are there differences? You've had these adventures in Japan, Cape Cod, California.
France, yeah.
Yeah. Are there differences culturally? The answer to this is yes, but what are the differences culturally between folks in Japan and France and California and the East Coast in terms of how people keep house?
Well, I think it's a money thing, you know. And you know what, though? I don't know if rich people are neater or just that they can afford cleaners more often. There's that sort of issue. And also, I think there's, my experience in Japan was that I lived with a group of cleaners who sort of have this 100-year-old commune that they go door-to-door and clean as a spiritual practice, and they offer it free.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really interesting. In fact, it was profoundly affecting on my life. And even to this week where, you know, I live in a neighborhood where someone had a barbecue across the street and left all their trash on the outside. And I for 2 days I looked out the window and I thought, I should go clean that up. And then, you know, people would say, no, those neighbors, they should have to clean up themselves, or you should say something. And, you know, after living with these people who selflessly clean, and I mean, you know, they don't own things, they don't want things, they consider cleaning a way to exchange humanness with other people and offer thanks for being alive. You know, finally on Tuesday morning this week, I got up, I couldn't stand anymore. I kept looking out going, is it still there? And I just went and cleaned it up. It took me 10 minutes. And I thought, you know, that was something that culturally saved me, that in this country we have this idea that if someone throw, you know, perhaps I would never litter, but if I was walking next to someone and they littered, I would probably think badly of them rather than reach down and pick up that thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very interesting to live with this group of people who, you know, don't have that, if it's not mine, it's not my problem issue. And I think that's something that is very interesting in this culture, that, you know, as long as my little space is clean, as long as my house is okay,
right,
I'm not going to worry about anyone else. And in my book, I suggest that, you know, in a place like New York, we should give every citizen a square yard. People are, in New York are always complaining about how they don't have a yard, and my idea was to give them a square yard and say, clean it. And, you know, it's because there's this idea that if it's not personally owned, it's not our responsibility.
Mm.
So that was very interesting mm-hmm. to me, and I think has a long effect. It will have a long effect on my life.
Yeah.
Of course, I didn't come home from Japan and, you know, knock on doors as I had thought I would while I was meditating in Japan on how wonderful this world was. And I was, you know, I thought, well, there's a lot of people that could use cleaning that can't afford it. I should give my services. I should just knock on the door and say, I'm here to clean your bathroom. And I thought, you know, I'd probably get arrested.
I know. Shelters would love to have you.
Yes, it's true. It is true.
That's something that, yeah. you know, sometimes people don't know. Well, if I volunteer, what can I do? And
right.
There's, you know, the folks that run shelters, they're looking desperately for someone to come in and
right.
take this stuff out of the fridge and clean it out and then put the stuff
Absolutely.
Back in. Absolutely. And everybody can do that. Anybody, yeah. just about anybody can do that.
Yeah. I think, you know, and I have there's a vacant lot on our street, and I thought, you know, it would look great if it was cleaned up. And, you know, it's just that kind of bringing your mind out from your own little place. So even though this book, I think, is very funny, I think it does challenge those ideas of how we live in the world and how much we just want to sweep under the rug or dump it on the moon or do whatever mm. it is that we do with our trash and our responsibility towards other people.
I want to talk a little bit more about Japan. It's got to be very unusual for a foreigner to get a job in Japan, let alone a job cleaning. And I know this was a different kind of,
right.
this was not a paying job.
No, it was not a paying job.
But still, for a foreigner to be involved in that kind of work, I would think would be kind of touchy.
Well, I think the people in the commune, especially the teenagers, thought it was very funny that this American was coming over to live with them and clean toilets. I kept saying, I want to clean toilets. And to be honest, they did very frequented by homeless that are not very seen, you know, very often seen in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really interesting because I had my own prejudices and ideas, and this thing happened where we were cleaning around a large group of men who were kind of drunk and, you know, obviously had been there all night and thrown their trash around. And I got kind of nervous approaching them because being a white American in Japan, it you do stand out still in this way, and especially in this town we were in. And I thought, oh, no, I'm going to get some kind of, you know, approach. Or, especially in this country, you would, you know, if you started sweeping up next to
yeah.
a group of drunken homeless men, you might get some sort of issue happen. And the remarkable thing was, you know, the people I was working around were just very steady. You know, they weren't all jazzed up, or at least I couldn't tell. What happened was these guys got up and started cleaning up their own mess. And I thought, oh, my God, you know, I don't know what that means. It was some kind of you know, sort of spiritual awakening in some way where you thought, oh, if I take responsibility, if I just do this very simple thing, then the world has a possibility of this other thing happening. And these guys were not difficult towards me at all. In fact, they got up, they said a few words, they found out I couldn't speak Japanese, and they started cleaning up around me. It was very interesting.
Hmm. There was also something that was interesting about Japan. You know, I think of Japan as super clean. You know, you mentioned there's no graffiti.
Yeah.
There's no litter.
Yeah.
But there's kind of a sordid underside
yeah.
in the culture that you can buy soiled underwear.
Yeah. I was shocked. I did see it. You can buy, you know, teenage girls' underwear in vending machines on the street. And, you know, I think they have their own irony and you know, whatever it is, the hypocrisy of their culture is in there too, and certainly we all know that there is this thing about Japan that's two sides of the thing. But you know, it was interesting to be out into the larger Japanese world and then go to this commune where people had simplified their lives and tried really hard to live this pure life. And I, you know, I think that there's everything in that culture as well as there is here. I just think that it's more hidden.
Mm.
But I did like the taxis. I only was in ones, but it was so clean and sweet smelling, and had doilies and Kleenex, and I was just shocked. And, you know, the subways were carpeted and pristine. It was, you know, coming from New York, I was shocked. I was, yeah. Oh, my God, why don't we just clean up the subways in New York? It'd be so easy. No.
Sometime back I heard that young people in Japan love Mr. Donut.
Yes.
And it was fun reading how you enjoyed Mr. Donut as well while you were there.
I love Mr. Donut. And one of the things that this commune that I stayed at does is run, I guess you would call it corporate training sessions for, in this case, employees of Mr. Donut. And I was there where a lot of junior execs were being trained, and they were going out dressed in karate gis, in bare feet, in the cold winter months, like everyone else, jogging into town and going door to door and asking for the humble service of toilet cleaning. And of course, in Japan, they have quite a different corporate culture where, you know, affinity towards the business and humility and good service is very valued. And so one of the things that this commune does now that it sort of doesn't self-support by money is run these training sessions. And I just had this idea that, you know, you just could not imagine junior Dunkin' Donuts managers running around America asking to clean toilets. I mean, that was just shocking. And getting up at 5:30 in the morning and chanting the toilet cleaning poem at the morning services, which these guys were doing, even though they were sort of nodding off. You know, you walk into a Mr. Donut and they are just like smiling and nodding and saying, "Hello, may I humbly serve you?"
Mm-hmm.
And wow, it was pretty interesting.
Can you give us an idea of the toilet cleaning poem?
It's a lot about, I don't have it in front of me, I'm sorry, right. But it's a lot about life-giving, that work, it's about work being, working as a graciousness and a gratefulness to God or whoever you want to call it, instead of working as a way to live, it's working as a thanks to live. And so that's an interesting change. The person who started this sect actually was a landowner who was a failed businessman and in the 20s had a spiritual awakening about how the idea of capitalism and getting more for yourself wasn't giving back or graciousness to the world. It was actually taking it and sort of screwing people out of whatever they had. He went into some very long meditation. He owed a lot of people money and got the answer in his meditation that by working for people, he could pay off this debt and not simply move to another province or, you know, whatever was being suggested to him at the time.
The work ethic meets a cleaning ethic.
Yes. And he, you know, has very beautiful pictures of this guy. And the woman that I stayed with there had lived, you know, sort of 30 years with him as his secretary and right-hand person and translator. And, you know, she was quite something. She really humbled me in terms of humbled service, that's for sure.
Hmm. Writer Louise Rafkin is our guest this afternoon. Louise is also a house cleaner, and she's the author of the new book, Other People's Dirt, A House Cleaner's Curious Adventures. The book is published by Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call. Toll free 1-800-222-9455 in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Don't be shy. Louise can't see into into your home if you give us a call. There are house cleaners who will work in skimpy dress or naked.
Or nude, yes. I did actually explore the world of naked house cleaners. And although I didn't do it myself, I felt a little bit shy about that. I did find women and men who are sort of part of this cleaning slash escort world, and some of them clean and some of them don't clean, but it was a very interesting world. $85 an hour was what I was quoted in New York, and in San Francisco I found someone who, a guy who was getting about $200 an hour, but people could videotape him cleaning. And that was an interesting world. You know, anything in this culture can be commoditized, I suppose.
Yeah, suddenly those vending machines in Japan don't sound
yes,
so strange.
Exactly. Right.
Who are the clients likely to be? What, you know, what?
Those clients?
Yeah.
Well, the women in New York told me that they were basically lonely men and that probably wouldn't want to call a call girl or a sex escort, but needed their house clean and thought, oh, I'll kill two birds with one stone sort of thing, I guess. And, you know, these women were very beautiful and young and you know, seemingly in control of the situation. Although I said, what do you mean, you guys? Do you know self-defense? You know, you're going into these homes in Manhattan and you know, with no clothes on and high heels. And, you know, they were very funny. They said, well, you have to watch out for the ashy circles on your stockings if you're kneeling. And I thought, oh, brother. But, you know, they were pretty funny. And I suppose there can be some sordidness in it. But you know what I figure is, you know, live and let live. And it's kind of amusing.
Any brushes with fame as a result of your work?
Well, I did hear Barbara Streisand's voice on the answering machine at the precise moment I had my hands in the toilet at a house. I've worked for several sort of Hollywood people, screenwriters and agents, and I did take Carol King's number from a Rolodex once and called her at her Malibu home and asked her to sing Happy Birthday to my friend. So I guess that was a little snottiness on my part.
Wow.
It was a little more investigative, but she never called, so I don't know whether I can be held to that. But, you know, it was interesting sort of being around people that you hear about in People magazine and, you know, while you're dusting the answer machine, it'll click on, and there's somebody.
Now, you're cleaning the toilet. What a mundane kind of thing to be doing. I mean, generally, I mean, there is that sect in Japan who thinks of it in a very different way.
Right.
Was Barbara Streisand, was she just leaving a mundane kind of thing?
Yeah. Nothing personal to me. Dang.
She didn't say,
maybe,
you know, something outrageous.
Maybe she'll hear this, though, and maybe she'll want me to clean for her or, I don't know, have tea or something. Who knows?
Yeah. Well, I wonder with this book now whether the demand for your services will go up or down.
Well,
you don't name names, though.
No, I don't name names. Yeah. But I did get fired by a couple of people initially when the seed for this book was published in the New York Times Magazine. Several of my clients, including my initial gynecologist, fired me. And I think that it was that thing where, you know, there's an unspoken agreement that you are not to talk. And, you know, they didn't pay me enough not to talk.
Have you had an embarrassing moment when a client discovered something about you that you hadn't intended to reveal?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I did, I don't know. Do I have to say it?
Well, I don't know if it's the thing that I'm thinking about.
What are you thinking about?
I'm thinking about making use of a client's bedroom.
Well, I did have sex in a house.
We just told.
But I didn't. I wasn't discovered. I mean, I self-revealed. I wrote about it in the book just to make sure that everyone knew I wasn't above my own curiosity.
Yeah, but you weren't caught in that.
No, I wasn't
situation.
Caught. No. And I've never really done anything bad. I mean, even to this moment, someone just called me and said, I'm going to Cape Cod for July 4th and I need a place to stay. And, you know, I didn't think to offer the fact that I have like 20 keys in my drawer at this very moment to beautiful houses on Cape Cod, some of which I assure will be empty during that week. So I haven't gone into the bed and breakfast business. Phew, yeah. Maybe the locks are being changed as we speak.
You might need another career. You might have to go into archaeology or anthropology.
I did just get a teaching job, actually,
after
20 years.
Before agreeing to go to work for someone, what do you want to know about them? Do you, you know, sort of want to know if they're okay and if you want to work for them?
Well, you know, it's the kind of thing where someone will call you and go, oh, my house isn't that messy and my kids will be down here this week, and I just want it a little cleaned up. And then, you know, I learned early on that you can't trust people's, self-diagnosis, that you have to go see, you know. So one person's dirt is not another person's dirt. And, uh, you know, so I used to take jobs on the phone, like, oh, yeah, I got a couple more hours on Thursday, I'll come by. But I don't do that because you never know what you're going to get. And I went to one guy's home who, you know, I think he didn't even know what color the countertops were anymore. And, you know, after 7 hours just in the kitchen, and my partner was in the bathroom, we had just sort of degreened the place, and he was thrilled and said, you know, he was one of those people that said, I'll call you when the rest of the house needs it. And I thought, you know, don't call me. But I have now learned that there are things I need to know, you know, like how many people are actually going to be in the house. And, you know, I prefer to clean an empty house. You don't really want to have to clean around people. And plus, you know, maybe I want to listen to Jerry Springer. Who knows?
You wouldn't.
I wouldn't. I was just saying that because it was NPR. I'm actually addicted to NPR.
If you were cleaning houses here in Champaign-Urbana, you'd be listening to the Afternoon Magazine.
I would. I never miss Terry Gross.
Okay, well, she'll be on later here on AM 580.
Good.
I want to thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon.
I'm so glad to.
It's been a pleasure. Louise Rafkin has been our guest. Look for her book, Other People's Dirt, A House Cleaner's Curious Adventures. The book is published by Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill.